Hey friends, I'm Stacy.
And I'm Liz.
And we love chatting about teen books.
What makes our podcast a little different is that we want to encourage your curiosity beyond the book.
So how will we do that? Each month, we'll feature one book and discuss its highlights. You know, the things that made us love it.
And we'll also share the things that didn't knock our socks off.
Then we'll explore what the book taught us and how it inspired a curiosity of information well after the story finished. So now, let's get on with our episode.
Tell me, O muse, of those loyal listeners who have streamed that most famous podcast, The Curious Reader. Many episodes did they download, and many were the books they heard discussed at length by those two ever-ridiculous hosts, Stacy and Liz. Tell me, too, about all of these things, O daughter of Jove, from whatsoever source you may know them.
And that is how the characters in this week's book would probably choose to begin their own podcast if they had a podcast, which they probably don't because they're more interested in Greek mythology.
And that book is Lore by Alexander Bracken. That is the book that we are talking about this week. And don't worry, that will be the last Odyssey knockoff that I do during this podcast, probably.
But we still are ridiculous hosts. So
that is true.
Yeah.
Okay. So to summarize Lore, many centuries ago, nine of the gods of Olympus betrayed their king Zeus. To punish them, Zeus created a competition known as the Aegon, a period of 7 days occurring every 7 years when Poseidon, Athena, Artemis, Apollo, Hermes, Dionysus, Aphrodite, Hephaestus, and Ares would be made mortal and hunted by the descendants of the most famous Greek heroes. If a god is killed by one of those hunters, that hunter acquires the god's powers and that god's place in the Aegon. Wow. So for the next Aegon, it is that hunter who has ascended to godhood who will be hunted instead.
Crazy.
So flash forward to now, today, New York City, and it is the start of the most recent Aegon. Melora Perseus, descendant of Perseus, known as Lore, was raised to be one of these hunters. But 7 years ago, her parents and her sisters were all killed, and now all she wants is to be left alone. And then a wounded and dying Athena shows up on her doorstep begging for her help. And Athena makes Lore a deal she can't refuse. In exchange for helping her survive the week, Athena will hunt down and kill Wrath, the hunter who killed and replaced Ares, and the person responsible for murdering Lore's family. Also turning up after many years away is Lore's childhood best friend, Castor. Castor is quite different from the last time Lore saw him, and he needs someone that he can trust to get through this Aegon as well. What starts out as a story of vengeance and survival for Lore and her allies turns into a game with much higher stakes, and Lore is at the center of it. Now, I don't want to give too much away, which is why I am being so cagey, because the twists and the turns are a part of what makes this story a really fun one. But suffice to say that this Aegon is the Aegon to end all Aegons. Lore is an action-packed and fast-paced and inventive Percy Jackson meets the Hunger Games kind of story, and I'd say it's probably not like anything you've read before. Is there anything you'd add, Stacey?
Yeah, no, I think... There's a lot there. I know it probably seems like a little confusing. And so the one thing I will say, like when we talk about, I think you talked about Wrath, right? So to kill Wrath. So when the mortals, right? So the hunters can, during this, when they go out to kill the...
Hunt.
Yeah, to hunt, to kill the gods. They, so say like somebody goes and kills, you know, Hermes, then that hunter gets to then take on those powers and be immortal. And then they also get to pick their own name. And that was strange to me because I was like, why are they like Wrath? What is this weird? Like, who is that? So they get to pick their own name and not have to stay with the name of that god, which is kind of neat.
That is an excellent point. Yeah. For example, in the book, we start off with, so someone has killed, like a while ago, Aphrodite.
Yes.
Right. And now that person's name goes by Heartbringer?
No, Tiebreaker, right?
That's Poseidon.
Oh, okay.
All right, rewind. Oh, someone has killed Poseidon, and they go by Tidebreaker.
Yes, you're right. Actually, I think it is Heartbreaker. I think that that is what it is. And lore makes like a funny thing, like these names are getting so ridiculous. Or somebody says they're like, the names are getting so ridiculous. But yes, you get to pick like this name you want to go by.
Your cool nickname now.
You're cool. Yeah. So I don't know. I just wanted to throw that in there because I think it took me a little bit to understand that. And it was kind of confusing to me.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I suppose another thing that I found a little bit confusing was in the beginning of the book, it lists like all the families, like the hunters' families, the descendants of these Greek heroes.
Yeah.
And it tells you if they are associated with a new god. So if a member of their house has killed one of the old gods, the nine that I named, and ascended. And so the god that they killed. So, for example, Poseidon. Mm-hmm. The god who was killed and is now Tidebreaker. Poseidon had nothing to do with that house. It just so happened that a member of that house killed Poseidon.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, yes. Just want to put that out there. Yeah.
And now with that out of the way, what was your hit, Stacey? Okay. What did you like about this book?
So, I really I thought the, you know, Percy Jackson meets Hunger Games. I really liked this modern setting for a story that involved Greek gods. I also really liked how technology plays a part in it, right? Because we're at modern times, okay? And so there, particularly there's a messenger who's like a hunter but actually doesn't do any killing or hunting or
he's
anything.
He's a spy.
He's a spy,
he's essentially a spy.
And so one of the messengers in here has like some really awesome cool tech. So there's a lot of tech. But then it also was crazy to me that when the hunters go out, they actually have these ancient weapons that they are still using to kill the gods or to kill the fake god when they want to be now that god.
Right.
There's a lot of killing.
But, and so the reason that they continue to use ancient weapons is because they know if they kill a god with their ancient weapons that they take on the powers. And no one wants to risk, for example, like taking a gun and shooting a god, killing them, and then not gaining their power. So they don't know what's going to happen, and they're not going to risk it. So they schlep around New York with giant swords strapped to their back.
And, you know, bows and arrows and, and a dory. And I meant to look up what a dory was, and I didn't look it up. But that was
a long spear.
Yeah, and that's what I kind of, So I really liked that part. I also thought the funny antics of Athena. I actually did like Athena's character. I mean, it's not like they go into her too much as of her godlikeness. I don't know. But there was just something about her, her very frank comments.
It's very Thor in the first Thor movie.
Yes.
He's like a she's a, like a cold and removed god who's now in modern New York.
And and she fashions all of these weapons. So, of course, you know, she needs weapons and she's, you know, for everybody else. And she's fashioning them out of anything she can find in this house, like a mop, a broom, a curtain rod, into her like ancient weapons that she would want to use, which I thought was pretty hilarious as well. So I loved all that. What else did I love? Actually, with Athena, I thought was so funny. So like this mop head comes up and she licks, like tastes it. And she's like, she goes over to it and she's like, she like licks it. And then she's like disgusted and she wants to know what animal it was derived from, which I thought was hilarious. So that would be a chemical synthesis. Yeah, that'd be synthetic fibers there, Athena.
But at the same time, what mop tastes good?
Yes, like no mop should taste good. And I was trying to figure that out too. Like, was she,
like
I don't know.
The dirtiest part of the mop.
Like, if we had a lamb, like, would we like tasting the fleece? I don't know. Like, what? I don't know. That was weird.
Well, but so that was a thing that I thought was very cool as well, having, you know, this Greek mythology playing out in the modern world. And another thing that I thought was so cool about it was that, so none of these characters are like completely stuck in the past, right?
No.
Like they all live in the present. They all deal with all these like Greek mythological things that still exist, but they all deal with the present, including the gods. So it's kind of this idea that like the age of Greek mythology that we imagine never ended. Like they kept going on.
Yep.
They've kept like growing and changing and adapting, and they've kept having these adventures. So like if someone were to write down the adventures that they've had, you know, since millennia ago, it would read very similar to how like the myths that we read now sound. And I just think that's really cool. It's like just, the idea that it just kept going. It never ended.
Just happening in Manhattan.
Exactly.
Because that's where they are, in Manhattan. So I liked that. I really liked a lot of the fighting and war. I liked the action. I thought it was really, really, really good. And I also liked the sarcastic wit in the one-liners from Athena, but also the other characters, because there's some heavy stuff in here, especially later on in the near the end of the book. It gets a little dark, but it's cut through with some funny one-liners and wit from the characters, which I really, really liked. You know, but there are some pretty vividly written scenes of battle carnage.
And that happened in an unexpected way. Because remember, you've got ancient weapons and you've got like drones. So
I know
it's
and
very
you still
cool.
have civilians or the what were they called? The unblooded that are still going around to their
completely
you know, jobs
oblivious.
And you know yeah oblivious to what's going on except that an explosion happened over here and that something's going on over there and but
you essentially have one scene where Athena is being Wonder Woman. Basically,
yes.
And saving a bunch of, you know, unblooded civilians from like an explosion mm-hmm. because she is the protector of cities. So what's she going to do? She's going to protect
that city. Yeah. You know, and I'm thinking about this, like as she's like walking around on the sidewalks, like carrying Castor, which we'll find out about him.
I was just picturing Wonder Woman the whole time.
Yeah. Just walking around. Somebody slung over her shoulder. Come on, I'll carry him. And she kept saying that. She's like, I'll carry him. I'll carry him. I'll carry him. Anyway, loved it.
Yeah. And also, so another hit for me, something that I really enjoyed were all the twists in the book. Mm. Right from the beginning, the author, Alexandra Bracken, introduces all of these mysteries and secrets and threads. And we're not sure where they're going, but they were very compelling to me. Like I needed to keep reading to find out what was going to happen. And I think it's so like you're not sure necessarily what's going to play out and what's not. So I couldn't put it down. And then as you keep reading, even within that, there are so many twists and turns and betrayals and reveals and so many things happening that it really held my attention and I was on the edge of my seat. And I usually pride myself at being pretty good at guessing what's going to happen, like pretentiously so. But this one had a few surprises for me and a few times when I was kicking myself for not seeing it because after the fact, oh, it was so clear.
Yeah.
That's what was going to happen. So it's a really compelling series of twists there. Like the plot really keeps you going.
And so what I would say, if you pick this book up to read, if you haven't read it yet and you're picking this book up to read, it is a hefty book, like 500 and something pages. There is a lot to this. I would suggest not letting it linger. I think that the action and the storyline and the plot twists and everything going on, you're going to want to just sit down and go through it.
Mm-hmm.
But because there is so much to, I would say don't think you're going to be able to pick it up on a Sunday night when you have to work early tomorrow morning and you can't get through it and then not come back to it again until the next weekend. Don't do that. Like carve out the time to just get
read
through
it all
the whole
at once.
Book.
Yeah. Yeah. Jam it into your
maybe
brain.
Maybe just call in sick. Like if, you know, or, you know, I'm not advocating any teens calling in sick to school. No, don't do that. Forget it. Yeah. But I'm just saying carve out the time.
Well, so not the calling out sick part, but the rest of it kind of rolls into actually what one of my misses was.
Okay.
And that is that there is indeed so much going on in this book. And especially at the beginning, it's not a bad thing that there's so much going on in this book. There are a lot of characters. There's a ton of history and there's a ton mm-hmm. of individual backstories to these characters as well as their shared history. And then there are on top of that, a ton of references to mythology that you may or may not be familiar with. If you're, you know, like me, you may be compelled to seek out and research every single thing, or you may let it, you know, like roll off your back.
Because you'll never get through the book if you research every single
there's
little
a lot.
Thing.
There's so much packed in here. I really enjoyed that, but we'll save that for later.
Okay.
But anyhow, so especially at the beginning, just tons of information was thrown at you, and it wasn't immediately apparent what was moving the plot forward mm-hmm. and what was just filler. So I was trying to like remember just as much as possible of everything because it felt like it all might pay off later. And sometimes it did in really great ways, but sometimes it didn't at all. So like one example that I found kind of funny was there's a scene in the beginning where Lore and her friend Miles, who is an unblooded, they're hanging out at a diner. And so in the narration, we're learning all about this diner and the owner of this diner. And then we're learning about the bodega, which is a kind of corner store, if you're not familiar, that's on the corner. And we're learning about the owner of that bodega. And we're learning about the cat who lives at that bodega and all of these informations. And don't get me wrong, I love a good bodega, but then we never go inside. We learn so much about this bodega, but Lore never actually enters the store.
Yeah.
So I was sitting there trying to be like, okay, how is this going to pay into the plot later? Like, what's going to happen? Like, what's going to happen at the bodega that's going to make it so important that I know about this cat?
Like, the cat's going to save them. The cat maybe is going to be, like, used that's where by I was the at gods. When I
was
I don't
reading
know.
At it. I was like, maybe this cat is the incarnation that we're looking for. No, that was not the case. So that is an example of one thing that did not pay out.
Don't spend too much time on the cat, anybody. Don't.
Or even like Stacey, when we were talking about this book this morning, you referenced a part where one of the villains just like casually outlines a plan to kill thousands of people, like something that he's worked on, something that, you know, he's just got going on the back burner. And I had totally forgotten about it because he mentions it once and then it's just never brought up again.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of info. Not all of it is as meaningful as you might try to make it.
Yeah.
So I would say, again, just let it roll over you. Just enjoy it.
Which then makes it a little more difficult, though, to figure out which clues in there might be part of the twist and turn. And
right.
For you to, yeah, there, definitely. So for me, the prologue was confusing. And actually, there's almost like two prologues because, like, you know, there's a thing from like, from Zeus, and then there's like this prologue, and I'm reading it, and you know, usually you have like a teasing glimpse of what's gonna then continue on in the book, and you're like, yeah. And I got to the end of it and I went, what? I'm not really sure what just happened. I don't know what's really going on here. Am I gonna figure it out? I don't know. And I did later on, but it was in a weird, I don't know, it was hard for me.
I really agree. Because, yeah, there are, like you said, there are two kind of prologues.
Yeah.
There's an official prologue, and then there's, like, an opening scene that doesn't, again, it's one of those things that isn't wholly necessary.
No.
And I get, you know, a lot of times authors like to introduce you to a story, you know, with some action. Oh, what's that word? And it's from the Odyssey, in media res, which means in the middle of the action.
Oh.
I should have looked that up for my curiosity. But anyhow, yes, I agree. We started off with action, but I didn't know who anyone was or anything about the world or what was happening. So
yeah.
I didn't find it meaningful. I just kind of found it confusing. And so it kind of put me off starting the book. Once I got into it, I enjoyed it a lot more, but I kind of had to push through that beginning part.
Yeah, that beginning part was tough. And so I actually would recommend maybe after you really have this plot line down, you really know what's going on, go back to the prologue and read it again, because then I think it has more meaning and a little bit more like, ooh,
yeah,
like substance to it. We also talked about how the list in the beginning of the book of like there's the living lines and the dead lines.
Oh, of the houses of the hunters.
Houses, yep. In the back of the book, there's a cast of characters. I really wish those were switched.
Yes.
I really think I would have done better with the cast of characters right in the beginning and setting it all up for me, because there are so many characters and I kept going to the back going, okay, hold on again. Wait, And I do wonder if that was up there, if maybe I would have understood the prologue a little bit better too. I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
Yeah, I really agree about that. And I was reading it as an ebook. I kind of split it between an ebook and an audiobook. So I didn't even know that cast of characters was there.
Oh, is it not even in the?
It might be. It's just that I didn't flip to the end first.
Okay.
And, you know, it's harder when you're reading an ebook. Like, you can't just, like, flip through the pages and see what's
right.
up.
Right. That's true.
But so I was sitting there, like, kind of trying to commit the houses to memory. And I was just like, I don't understand
what this
is. Yeah. But I got through it and then I enjoyed it. Just FYI.
We did. We got through it and it was good. So we do have some thoughts beyond the book. Like, Liz has some major thoughts beyond the book. She,
as usual, I had a lot of thoughts.
And some of this comes from also the fact that you were reading something else that, like, around the same time that ties in with Greek mythology.
Oh my goodness. Completely at random. So I had had a hold on the book Pandora's Jar by Natalie Haynes for a while. It's kind of recently out, but I've had a hold on it for a while. Just came in this weekend. I started reading it. Got so interested, I read it in one day instead of doing a lot of other things that I needed to do because it was so interesting. So Natalie Haynes, she's an author. Obviously, she's also like a classicist. Mm-hmm. Like her career has been studying the classics. And she's also kind of a comedian. So this book is super engaging. It's written for like if you haven't if you're not familiar with myths at all, like this is a really great book where she explains everything in just like a really casual manner. And what she does is she takes some of the, like the female characters from Greek mythology, and then she puts them in their original context. Like she brings you through all like the like original sources and original texts and tell you like how they were originally presented as opposed to like
how a cleaned up version of them.
Like how we might know them from like picture books we had as kids or like, you know, cartoons.
Right.
Because it's really different. So it was really interesting. And I had all this on my brain as we were talking about it.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's just a plug for Pandora's Jar by Natalie Haynes.
And going into this book and into that book that Liz just said, that these Greek gods are not your Disney Greek gods.
They are not.
Like, yeah, there's some heavy stuff in this book, and there is some vicious vengeance and death.
The myths themselves are quite bleak and quite dark, and this book gets into it a little bit, too, especially in the second half of the book. Yes. Really digs into it. And so, obviously, with all that on my brain, one of the things I was most curious about was tracing the references to Greek mythology. And there are so many references packed into, like, there are more than you even think there are. And obviously none of us will know all of them because even though I read one book, I am not an expert, despite all the information I rattled off at Stacey.
She sounded like an expert.
I read one book. knowing a little bit about it makes it way more fun. So I think we're all probably, you know, pretty familiar with gods like Poseidon and Athena and Ares. We're a little bit familiar.
Yep.
But there were a lot of references in there with which you might not be familiar. And so one thing I got really into was tracing why the author chose to name the characters what she chose to name them. So, for example, our main character's full name is Melora, and it's not a name that I'd ever heard of in Greek mythology. And so it's not actually the name of any mythological character. Most of the names in the book, I should mention, of, like, you know, the minor characters are, like, taken straight from Greek mythology. Like, she mentions, like, in Orestes.
Yep.
And now I can't remember any other character who arises, but that's fine. So they all have names from Greek mythology. But Melora, not from Greek mythology. So I looked it up, and wouldn't you know, Melora in Greek means golden apple. And that is extremely cool, because literal golden apples are a thing that pop up in several Greek myths, and they kind of serve a function, like the same function that lore does within this story.
Yeah.
So without getting into too many spoilers, everyone in the Aegon, after a while, they're coming after Lore, because she might be the key to, like, the ultimate prize. And golden apples show up in Greek myths as they're items of incredible value to be won. Like, Hercules is tasked with stealing some golden apples in order to complete his very famous 12 labors. Atalanta, a famous hunter, was tricked into marriage because of some golden apples that she was distracted by. And most famously, a golden apple inscribed with the words, "To the most beautiful," is what started the Trojan War. So in that story, three goddesses find such an apple. They immediately start arguing over who it should belong to, who among them is the most beautiful. So to settle this argument, Zeus makes Paris, the prince of Troy, pick the winner. So we've got a mortal man trying to choose between three goddesses as to who is the most beautiful. So I think you know this is probably not going to go well for him, whatever he chooses. So all three goddesses, they try to bribe him. So Hera, Zeus's wife, offers Paris a kingdom that covers Europe and Asia. Athena offers him, like, ultimate skill in battle. and Aphrodite offers him the most beautiful Helen for a wife, even though she is already married.
These gods.
She's stirring up some stuff. So Paris chooses Aphrodite's offer, runs off with Helen, and then goes on to start one of the most famous wars in history. So everyone's fighting over the golden apple. Everyone's fighting over lore. I thought that was a really
ingenious.
Cool connection.
Ingenious.
Indeed. Another really interesting name choice is Castor. So Lore's childhood friend, who is from the House of Achilles. Mm-hmm. So he just, you know, showed up on the scene after many years away. Lore has feelings for him. There is a little bit of romance in this book.
Mm-hmm. Some kissing, maybe?
There is some kissing. There's some kissing. But so Castor, as a name, is one that I'd heard before, but not usually alone. Because normally, you don't talk about Castor without talking about his twin brother, Pollux. So Castor and Pollux are the famous twins from the constellation / astrological sign Gemini. But the Castor in this book doesn't seem to have a twin, so it made me do some more research on why the author might have used that particular name. It turns out the other interesting thing about mythological Castor is that he and his brother were fathered by Zeus, so their nickname is the Dioscuri, meaning the sons of Zeus. Mm. However, there are many different stories about their origins, right? So in some stories, Zeus is both of their dads. In other stories, Zeus is Pollux's dad, but Castor's dad is the human king of Sparta, Tyndareus. So sometimes that means that both twins are demigods and immortal, but sometimes Castor is a regular old mortal. What could this mean? Please ruminate on other mythological twins in Greek mythology that you might have heard of, as well as perhaps the metaphorical idea of twins and twinning and doubles, and then read Lore, and then come talk to me, because I think that would be a really good discussion. I don't want to spoil anything else, so I can't tell you the answer, but I would love for you to come up with it, and then we can talk about it. And so I will leave you with just one more cool name, Evander. Van. He's Lore and Castor's childhood best friends. He's the coolest. He's British. He has drones.
Yep.
He's mysteriously missing a hand. I love him. And his name means a good man.
And he is a good man in this book. I think he is.
He's just a good man.
So he's the messenger that I was talking about earlier. And so this is a great segue because I had something that, not with Greek mythology, but that.
But speaking of mysteriously missing a hand.
Mysteriously missing a hand. So in this story, Evander, he has a prosthetic hand. And there's a part in here in the story where he has made this app that his hand can actually be made into like this drone that can be used to spy and, you know, deter. And I was just like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. Which then got me thinking about prosthetic limbs and, oh, are there really apps for them? Like, I don't think anybody's limb's going to come off and turn into, you know, a drone
helicopter.
They're going to be like a bird or anything like that. They're not going to help for spying. They're not going to, you know, win any wars against like the real gods. But I did some research and there's been huge advancements in prosthetic limbs. So I was really, really super excited about this, and I thought I'd share some of the information I found. So first of all, there is an app, just to let you know.
There's an app for
everything. There's an app for everything. So first, though, before we talk about the app, let's just talk about some of the advancements through the years. So there's been amazing advancements as far as technology. One of the more recent developments is microprocessors that can control joints. And they actually put these microprocessors in the prosthetic, and it can also then, with something within the brain, your brain can move the prosthetic. Wow.
That's bananas.
Now, it has been developed in the United States in the 1990s and made possible for things to automatically adapt to the person. John Hopkins, right now, University has recently developed the arm that can be controlled by the person's mind, specifically the brain signals sent directly to curl up to 26 joints. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Now the technology is not fully available at this time, but it's promising. They're still like testing it and working on it, but it's really, really looking promising. And of course, you know, we now have prosthetic limbs that have skin that looks like it's covering them. So they, you know, really do look not like that of old with just a claw or anything like that. But the app for iLimb, so if you have this, it's iLimb, I know. So if you have this prosthetic called iLimb, and then you have this app, in the app, you can actually work on different types of, for your hand, like different type of pinching movements. Mm-hmm. And you can control all these different types of movements to make it more precise for you. Also, you can test and look in there and make sure that your prosthetic is working properly, and it can automatically send off signals to your doctors so that if anything is going wrong, it can be erected and taken care of like right away. And then
that's really cool.
Additionally, there's a graph that can also, person can look at and see how they're using, what are the most movements that they use with their limb. And so all of these things can help doctors later on just improve what's going on with prosthetics. And I don't know. I thought that was like super kind of interesting. So aside from the sensors that we've talked about that, which, you know, can help control iLimb, the app is pre-programmed and you can pre-program common grips that you use in it too. So that if you're want to carry a laptop somewhere, you can then program that's the way you want to have your limb work. But then if you want to go over and take something out of the or use like a mouse and you just want like one finger to be able to do quick clicks, you can pre-program that from the app. If you want to go over to the refrigerator and like take something out and maybe you're only going to use like a few of your fingers, you can pre-program that. Like, it's super amazing.
So is it like something that you would have to like select on the app? So like,
yes, okay, you do.
So
you select
I would be
it.
Like, I'm going to go pick up my laptop. Open
yeah,
the
so
app,
there's
hit pick up laptop, then pick up laptop.
Well, I think that the different movements have certain names to them. So so then you would just be picking that type of grip or movement based off of there. And then you know like how that movement works for different things that you're trying to do.
So it's not like task specific necessarily.
Right.
You just know what grip works for what task.
Gotcha.
That's
exactly.
Really cool.
Yep. And so actually it even works with your Apple Watch. Just to
of course
let you
it
know.
Does.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Well, it is called the iLimb.
It is called that. And I think right now iOS is the only thing that it works with, so I don't think it works with Android. But I just thought that was super exciting.
That
like,
is.
In technology and just
Evander's prosthetic hand is probably, I'm assuming, made out of magic.
Yes, might. Yeah.
But it is very cool that we're almost there. We're almost at magic levels.
I know, right? Someday you might have a drone come up. I don't know. But that was pretty cool. So that was something that I was super interested in. And the other thing, Liz, we're going to move back a little bit to mythology right here for one quick second, because I found out that on the website for our author, at Alexandra Bracken's website, you can figure out by answering just 7 simple questions what house you would belong to in this story. Dun, 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 dun.
Well, I know what house I want to belong to, but I'm not going to say it out loud in case I don't get it.
Okay, so in this questionnaire, and we're going to do this right now, we're going to find out which of the 5 living bloodlines we would belong to. So I'm going to ask Liz the questions first, and we'll find out where she falls, okay?
Should we explain, or should we mention what those 5 houses are?
Oh, maybe we should.
The Greek heroes that they are named after.
Yes. Do you have that in front of you?
I don't either. Never mind.
Oh, darn. Okay. Well, let me see. Hold on.
Well, there's Cadmus. There's Achilles.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. There's Odysseus.
Yep.
There's Perseus.
Yep.
And then who's the last one?
Apollo? Did we say?
Oh, yeah. Apollo. There we go.
Yep. There we go. Okay.
Or no. Apollo's not the house. Apollo's
no,
the
Apollo's
god.
The god. See, I'm already confused again, and I already read the story. What was the other house? The living. for the love. We're going to find it because the book is right over here and we're going to look because we want you to have accurate information, listeners.
Oh, yeah. Phooey, I knew this one. So the living houses are the House of Cadmus, mm-hmm. the House of Odysseus,
yes,
the House of Theseus, the House of Achilles,
yes,
and the House of Perseus.
Okay. Oh, jeesh. Okay, so here we go. Question one. You face an opponent in a fight. What's the first thing you do? Do you attack? Hold back? Wait for them to come to you? Do you circle them? Look out for any signs of weakness? Or do you recall the research you did in preparation of the fight in order to ascertain your opponent's weaknesses?
I feel like out of those options,
these are the options you have to pick from.
I recall the research because I imagine that previous to knowing I was going to be in a fight, I was very anxious. So I did do a lot of online research. As this will be my first fight.
In combat, your weapon of choice would be a necklace. It'll dazzle your opponent with the jewels. A hammer, a trident, an armor and helmet, or a shield.
Trident.
Okay. All right. Next. What's your favorite Greek myth? You can only choose from these ones.
Okay.
Pandora's Box, The Fall of Icarus, The Abduction of Persephone by Hades, The Slaying of Gorgon Medusa, The Trojan War.
I will go with The Trojan War, for it is the longest.
Okay. All right. Which Greek hero would you hope never to cross paths with during the Aegon? Achilles. Okay.
He's the greatest of all the Greeks.
Okay. We don't even need to go any further. So he's the Greeks' best warrior during the Trojan War. See, this is why she picked. And his weakness? His left heel. Just so, you know, just to put it out there. All right.
What were my other options?
Well, I already changed.
Never mind.
Yeah.
I picked the
when
best
it's my turn, you'll find out. Which Greek god would you hope never to face the wrath of? Ares, Poseidon, Athena, Zeus, or Hades?
Oh, that is a tricky one.
Tricky.
That's tricky. I wanted to say Zeus, but I feel like there's a chance he would get bored and forget about me. Hades. I've got to pick Hades because that's forever.
Yeah.
If Hades is presiding over the afterlife, that's a long time for someone to be mad at you.
All right. You find a goddess in the body of a mortal bleeding to death outside your house. What do you do first? Do you get her inside as quickly as possible, making sure nobody sees you? Do you wash her blood away? Hunters could track the scent of her blood. Do you run away? You don't want to face the wrath of the goddess or the responsibility of saving her. Do you call a friend for help, even if they don't know anything about saving goddesses trapped in the body of mortals? Do you yell at her? How dare she come to you and bring the wrath of hunters to your home?
Those are my options.
Those are your options.
Okay, I feel like this is pretty specifically Athena on Laura's doorstep and not just like generally what would you do.
But what would you do? Not what did Laura do. What would you do?
I mean, I feel like I would probably yell at her. I'm not sure that it would be a choice. I feel like my first reaction would just be to shout at her in that situation.
Okay. So you're picking that?
Yep.
Okay.
That's what I'm picking.
All right. And your last one. Choose a house jewel. Emerald, sapphire, ruby, amethyst, or diamond? What?
Diamond.
Okay. Calculating your results. Boop, boop, beep, 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 beep. You belong to the House of Cadmos.
Oh, no.
You're an ambitious hunter and will stop at nothing to get what you desire. And not only that, but others admire you for your tenacity, your sharp eyes, and your wit. You're well-read and like to plan every little detail of any event you're involved in. You're a cunning fighter and often pick up on little details others would miss. You will do well in the upcoming Aegon.
Well, only parts of that were true. And that is not who I was hoping to get.
That's who you got.
I don't know how it starts over. Let's see.
For those of you who are wondering, the House of Cadmus is the house that Wrath is associated with.
Yes.
So they're kind of the big bads of this book.
They're bad.
It's true.
Bad.
It's just like every time I take a Harry Potter sorting quiz, I get Slytherin. What are you going to do?
All right. You want to try to tell me, Liz?
Sure.
Figure out what mine is.
Okay.
Here we go.
You face an opponent in a fight. What's the first thing you do? Attack. Hold back. Wait for them to come to you. Circle them. Look for any signs of weakness. Or recall the research you did in preparation of the fight in order to ascertain your opponent's weaknesses.
Yeah, I totally would also recall the research. That's totally what I would do.
In combat, your choice of weapon would be a necklace. I'll dazzle my opponent with my jewels. I'm sorry that we're reading this again. That was just very fun to say.
So I'm going to go with the helmet. The helmet and the shield. Okay. Right?
Armor and helmet.
Armor. That's it. Yes.
What is your favorite Greek myth? Pandora's box, fall of Icarus, abduction of Persephone by Hades, the slaying of Gorgon Medusa, or the Trojan War?
I'm going to go with Medusa.
Okay. I'm just saying, in most depictions, she is asleep when Perseus kills her.
I'm going with it just because I like to say Medusa.
That's true. Which Greek hero would you hope never to cross paths with during the Aegon? Achilles, Greek's best warrior during the Trojan War. Hercules, son of Zeus, his weakness, being too powerful. Atalanta, slaying of the Caledonian boar, her weakness, often underestimated by her opponents, or distracted by golden apples. Orion, son of God, Poseidon, and a great hunter, his weakness is often overcome with anger. Or Cassandra, the giver of prophecy, her weakness, no one believes her visions.
I think Cassandra.
I'm just curious as to why you would choose Cassandra, because you also wouldn't believe her.
But maybe I would. Constantly have doubt, and then I wouldn't want to know. And then I would be like, is that really going to happen? I don't know. And then I would just second guess everything I did, because maybe it is true.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
All right, which Greek god would you hope never to face the wrath of?
Yeah.
Ares?
No,
Poseidon.
Hades. Oh, totally. Hades. Yeah, totally.
You find a goddess in the body of a mortal, bleeding to death outside your house. What do you do first?
Cleaning up the blood.
Wash her blood.
I'm washing the blood.
Okay.
I am. I don't want anyone picking up that blood.
You don't want to run away?
No.
Abandon your home?
No. Washing blood.
Choose a house jewel. Emerald, sapphire, ruby, amethyst, or diamond?
Ruby.
Calculating results. You belong to the House of Odysseus. That's what I wanted.
Yeah!
You're a logical hunter and will always gather as much information as you can before setting out to do anything. On occasion, your logical side can overshadow the need for emotion. But in the Aegon, this is a trait that will only work to your advantage. You have a soft spot for the arts and are often seen as a progressive person, setting trends and making strides for new ventures. You have a way with words, and people often turn to you to explain and voice how they are feeling. You are a loyal friend and a fierce fighter.
Oh, some of that's true. I am a loyal friend. I do not have a way with words, but whatever. You know.
Just saying, Odysseus might be a loyal friend. Actually, he's not. Everyone else in the Odyssey died. Do you realize that he is the only one who survived the Odyssey? That is why it is called the Odyssey.
True. Well, I'm a loyal friend. Dun, dun, dun!
Don't go on a boat trip with Stacy, is what I'm saying.
Hey, now. That's not very nice. Okay, so that was our little fun for now. We're at the end of our episode, Liz. So this brings us to the next part of the podcast where we entice you to join us next month by introducing our next fabulous read. But first, before we get there, I need to let everyone know that this will be Liz's last episode with us. Cue the crying tears. Oh, I know. So I want to thank you so much for stepping in when I needed a co-host. And while Liz will not be on the podcast anymore, she will still have to put up with me talking about my podcast books because we'll still work together here on the second floor.
And quite frankly, I'm probably going to still beg her to read the books, at least a few of them, so that I can run over to her desk when my mind is blown about something that I read, or when I need to run something by her and she looks at me like, I don't know, I'm ahead of you in the book. Do you want me to tell you? No. And I run back to my desk. So thank you, Liz.
You're very welcome. This has been a whole lot of fun. I've never done a podcast before. This is great. It's also really enjoyable doing a buddy read with someone. I don't often do that, but it's super fun to be reading the same book as a friend at the same time. And it super helps if you spend 8 hours a day on the same floor so that you can constantly talk about it.
Exactly. See? That's why she's going to still want to read the books.
I am going to still read the books.
Yeah. So what does this mean then for the Curious Reader podcast? Because I know, listeners, that's what you're asking right now. No worries. So I have several teen librarians across the state of New Hampshire that are interested in being co-hosts and guest co-hosting with me. So you're going to hear some different people over the course of these next few months. And I think that we'll still have some great conversations. But next month, I am going to be discussing Carrie Firestone's realistic fiction book, Dress Coded, a story about the unequal enforcement of school dress codes, the students willing to stand up to protest that unfair treatment, and a podcast that brings it all to light. Molly Frost is fed up because Olivia was yelled at for wearing a tank top, because Liza got dress coded and Molly didn't, even though they were wearing the exact same outfit, and because when Jessica was pulled over by the principal and missed a math quiz, her teacher gave her an F, because it's impossible to find shorts that are longer than your fingertips, because girls' bodies are not a distraction, because middle school is hard enough. And so Molly starts a podcast where girls can tell their stories, and before long, her small rebellion swells into a revolution. Because now the girls are standing up for what's right, and they're not backing down. And I will have two special guests that are going to be co-hosting with me, so I am super excited. You're going to have to turn in to find out who they are, and that will be next month. So as always, we'd like to thank you for listening to the Curious Reader podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
So please click that heart or give us a thumbs up to share the love of reading and discovering something new.
And remember, the Curious Reader seeks understanding beyond the book.